prices. We've gotten to that point just about in the middle of our study, dealing with the personal sense of destiny and that of the invisible hero. And I was just looking at the notes, and I was reminded again that every believer has been given their very own portfolio of invisible assets. It's unfortunate that for most believers, they remain invisible. There should be a point in time in your life and in my life where these assets that have been given to us as believers of the church age from eternity past and set aside in escrow should be utilized, should be revealed, should be manifest. And it is, of course, to the invisible hero. The invisible hero is well aware of the fact that he has a personal sense of destiny. He has control of his life. He knows exactly what God intends for him. He not only knows God's will operationally, but also geographically. He knows where he is to do what he is to do. And that, of course, is the ideal circumstance in life. He is also occupied with the person of Jesus Christ. And because of that, he has a phenomenal magnetism, drawing blessing in his direction and often even impacting others through blessing by association. Some of you may not know it, but your association with a mature believer may be the only source of blessing that you'll ever receive in your life. And I would think that eventually you'd get to the point where you would desire that that blessing was directed to you rather than by association. That's like people who had become wealthy only because their parents were wealthy. But they never did anything to get that wealth or to gain that wealth. They just simply inherited it. I've often thought about what I'd like to be remembered as after I'm gone. And one thing that I'm sure would be evident, he was a man of the book. I don't care how much money I have or what impact I made on society in general from the standpoint of my genius, whatever that means. But that fellow believers would say, he's a man of the book. We already covered Romans 9:23, and then we went into detail in Ephesians chapter 1. And verse 18, obviously, is the central focus of this very thought, that the eyes of your understanding may be enlightened, so that you may know what is the hope of his calling, or the assurity of his calling. If you have any doubts in your mind about that word hope, we'll see you in Wednesday, Thursday night Bible class, because that's what we're currently are studying. As a matter of fact, we just began that study last Thursday night. What is the hope of his calling? What are the riches of the glory of his inheritance to the saints? You should know that. I mean, if you had an inheritance, wouldn't you want to know what the content of that inheritance was? If somebody died and left you all of their wealth, wouldn't you want to know to some degree what that wealth was worth? Or somebody gave you a key to a box and they said, everything that I've ever owned is in that safety deposit box. And you just let it ride. Never open it. God left you phenomenal gifts. And I like to put them in boxes because that means it's up to you to open the box. In Ephesians chapter 3, we just finished that last week. In verse 16, it says that he may give you, on the basis of the riches and glory, to become strong by means of power through the Holy Spirit in your inner being. Or as the New King James translates it, your inner man. That man created after Christ Jesus. You see, that's the one you reflect when you're filled with the Spirit, the new man. Now we know who the old man is. The old man is the first husband. The new man is made and in the image of Christ. He indwells us. The Shekinah, the glory of Christ, indwells us. That's why we're called the temple of the Holy Spirit. Don't you know that you are the temple of God and that He's in you? And you're not your own. You're bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God. You don't belong to you. You know, to hear the average believer, you'd think that they were theirs. And they do their own thing. They could care less about what God thinks. And I'm amazed even when I talk to believers who are supposedly very church-oriented. They're still doing their own thing. Most of them don't have a clue as to what the Christian life is all about. And they go wandering aimlessly through life, making bad decisions from bad choices, from wrong thinking. For the church age believer living on planet Earth, you have no destiny apart from the protocol plan of God. Your relationship to God's plan is your destiny. Not your plans, His plans. And if you want to live a meaningless life, then try to go apart of God's plan. And many believers do. They're constantly fighting the plan of God in their life. And yet there is nothing more meaningful nor satisfying nor blessing directed than when you're in God's plan. It's so really peaceful to know that you're in the center of God's will. And I would imagine it's frustrating because you don't have the answers. And you see, believers in fellowship are bombarded with as many problems as believers out of fellowship. The difference is the believer in fellowship who acknowledges and understands the problem-solving devices has the right answers. The others don't. Oh, they come up with answers. It's not the right one, though. And the Christian life is not a matter of guessing or trying this, that, the other. You know, this hit-and-miss thing. To attain your destiny as an invisible hero, you have to pass the three stages of suffering for blessing. Now, this is the part we don't like, because we don't like to suffer. There's never been a day in my life that I got up that morning and prayed, "Father, I want to suffer today for blessing." Sorry. I want the blessing, forget the suffering. Doesn't come that way. And the first area of breakthrough without regard is called providential preventive suffering. And I'm sure that most of you, I've said this often, but I think some of you have no idea what I'm talking about when I say that. So I thought what I would do probably for the remainder of this lesson is to deal with the two areas of preventive suffering. So let's start a study of the personal sense of destiny under the general heading of the first of the three stages of suffering for blessing. You see, what are the other two stages? First is providential preventive suffering. And we're going to see two areas in that department. Secondly, or point B, momentum testing. That we're well aware of. God will allow certain things in our life to see whether we can continue on. Last evening I was watching a boxing match, and I couldn't believe how these guys beat on each other for 10 rounds. They must have been in phenomenal shape. Well, it had to do with endurance. And you could tell they were tired at the end. I would have been finished after the first minute of the first round if he didn't knock me down first. I'm not known for my long distance anything. I could never be a long distance runner. I remember one time we were back in New York and I decided that I was going to shovel the snow leading from a point to another point, and I can't do anything in moderation. So I started acting like a snowblower, and I was just shoveling as fast as I could. And after I got it all done, I went in the house and collapsed. I literally fainted. I just blew it all. Did the same thing in June of 1968, just prior to my coming here as the pastor of the church. We were visiting my in-laws then, my wife's parents, and I decided I was going to wash the Pontiac. So it was in the heat of the day. I went out there and did a washing as I would in New York, on Long Island. And about halfway through, you know, I,
I started to get woozy and queasy and lightheaded, and I went back in the house and I had to lie down for at least a half hour. Stupid, yes. I always put 110% in anything I ever did until I got 60. Then I started hitting on about five cylinders. At 65, 3.5. At the rate I'm going, I'll never make it to 70. Evidence testing is the last one. And evidence testing, of course, has to do with, similar to momentum testing, these are things in your life, obvious things that God allows in your life to see whether or not you're moving on, whether you have learned the principle. And remember, you don't move on until you pass. So the first one you're going to be confronted with is providential preventive suffering. Now, there are two areas of preventive suffering. One is called preventive suffering. Punitive preventive suffering. And I'll explain that. And the other is providential preventive suffering. Preventive suffering is defined as short-term suffering from the sovereignty of God for the benefit of the believer. So in every case, it is beneficial to the believer. And in every case, it comes from God. One is providential. The other is punitive. But they both have basically the same design. The design is to get you back in or to get you moving, to get your momentum built. Punitive preventive suffering is suffering related to sin. And that certainly is in contrast to providential suffering. Providential suffering is that suffering which prevents, restrains, or insulates the believer from sin and evil. And so there is suffering in the life of the believer that actually becomes the insulator for sin or from sin. And you'll remember, to make this simple for you to remember it, providential preventive suffering is what Paul experienced, and so sometimes this could be called the suffering of the thorn. Remember, he tells us in the Corinthian letter, in 2 Corinthians, that he'd received a thorn in the flesh, lest he should glory above measure. And that apparently stayed with him the rest of his life. Now, we don't know exactly what it is, except for the description that he gives us. He says, a messenger of Satan to buffet me. And the word buffet means to slap in the face, to actually punch in the mouth. It could also be a pesky fly. Do you ever have one of those? You know, they're right here. And you shoot it out of the way, it's right back again. I often experience that fishing. You get these little gnats, and they just won't get away from you. Right there. And I've even had flies go under my glasses and be crawling on the inside of my lenses. And you'd shake them off, and they looked like they were drunk, frankly. I think they were on their death wish, because it wasn't long before I helped them. I gave them assisted suicide. I hooked them up to all the things and let them have it. Let them watch them die. Whatever it was, Paul says it was a reminder to him. At first, you say, he prayed about it. And he says, remove this thing from me. God says, what are you asking? You're asking me to remove the very source of blessing that I brought in your life. That's your source of blessing. That was preventive suffering. It prevented him from sin. You say, well, that was because he was occupied with this. Well, he was also occupied with the grace of God. Because finally, when he comes to his senses, you can see at first he's complaining and says, but wait a minute, thy grace is sufficient for me. See, it's the same Apostle Paul that said, I've learned one thing, that whatever state I am in, therein to be content. So as he began to grow in the Lord, his enthusiasm began to be more humbled. That's not saying that you shouldn't be enthusiastic, but sometimes without direction, your zeal just becomes a waste of time. You know, beating the air. I think I gave you that analogy here a couple of weeks ago. Paul says, I'm not as one who beats the air. And you have to take the whole background of that passage. It's obviously talking about the games. But they didn't wear boxing gloves. They wore leather gloves that had been dipped in some type of adhesive, and then they would break glass, and they would simply put the gloves into the glass. And so if you beat the air, that means you missed your target. And you know what's coming next, don't you? A left hook or a right cross. A good uppercut would kill someone. And only one survived. He was the winner. The other guy never fought again. He had no face. Generally, they died. You couldn't give up. You couldn't say, okay, what was it that that guy said in Spanish? No mas, or something like that. No, stop, I'm hurting. So when Paul says you don't beat the air, you don't miss. Some have likened that to shadow boxing. I don't think so. I think it goes a lot further than that. The whole objective when you're involved in fisticuffs is to make sure that your fist cuffs his face. Now, I'm not a violent person, but I do enjoy the fights. The Tuesday night fights on USA and the fights or boxing after dark on Showtime or HBO. Enjoy that. Not because I like to see blood. I don't like to see blood. I just like the ingenuity involved and the tactics that are used. And some of these guys are experts at getting out of the way. But they all agree to one thing. Every one I've ever heard interviewed says, it takes more out of you to miss than it does to hit the target. You don't practice to miss. See, your whole life is spent in hitting something, whether it be the bag, whether it be the little one that, you know, that one, back and forth, or the big bag. That's like a body bag. No, it's not like a body bag. A body bag is what you put a person into, not hit. You know that thing I'm talking about. The long bag, the big bag, what do they call it? The heavy bag, thank you. The punching bag. And there's that other one that has that little backstop, and you kind of do one of these numbers with it. That's to give you. And then there's one that goes back and forth like this, like the weaving and bobbing of your opponent. You want to hit that thing because you don't practice to miss. And so when you miss, your body uses more energy than it does if you hit the person. I'm not as one, Paul says, as beateth the air, or beats the air in modern English. A lot of believers out there, and all they're doing is beating the air, making a lot of noise. Oh, and they're in the limelight, all right. They got their name in some book. So providential preventive suffering is suffering which prevents, restrains, insulates sin and evil, while challenging spiritual self-esteem and suffering for blessing and profit. You see, whenever you come through one of these suffering areas or tests, if you pass, you're always better off than you were before. That's the whole point of it. And God is so gracious, you know, He says, all right, you didn't pass. Take the test again. No one passes onto the next plateau without passing that test. And I know there are certain areas in my life as I was growing in the Lord, and it seemed like it was an impossible situation. I keep saying, oh, no, I can't pass this test. And finally I did. And then another one came along that seemed impossible. They always seem greater and greater, by the way. Don't think it's going to get easier. Oh, I'm in maturity now, so I'll just kick back, kick off my shoes, and, you know, Now, you may have a respite for about 6 months to a year, and that's about it. Then the problems start again. Not that they weren't there before, but God kind of gives you an R&R. Take a break. And each plateau of spiritual growth, there's a season of relaxation. But remember, that's one of the times that we're the most vulnerable. We forget that the enemy's still out there, and he's not interested in giving us R's and R's. He could care less about our rest. He wants us to become completely and totally disoriented to God's plan for our lives. And the obvious way in which he does that is to disassociate us from the Word of God. If he can do that, he's won. You've lost. That's your roadmap to the Christian way of life. I rely more and more on roadmaps, whether they be drawn by another. And there were times, I remember my wife and I, we did a lot of traveling cross-country, and some of the maps that we had were outdated. Some of the maps we currently have are completely outdated. And you're going along, and then all of a sudden, and one night I remember, we were traveling from Phoenix to Cedar City, Utah. Wasn't quite Cedar City, but near there. And they had actually changed the name of one of the highways going north. Our map said whatever the number was, and the road that we should have been on should have had an A after it. They'd actually reversed them. And later we found out that these two were actually reversed sometime in the past. Well, I ran out of gas. Never could make it to the next town. And the three girls were sick. No, the two girls were sick. Lori wasn't born yet. She was in the cradle at the time. That's right. Robin had the flu. Pam had the flu. And both of us ended up with the flu. And that was that Asian variety. You know, where every aperture leaks. And, of course, since the engine couldn't run, it was about 25 below zero. So we were wrapped up in blankets. And they were getting sick. You know what blankets happens to blankets when little girls get sick? Then it works like a chain reaction. So I decided, like a fool, again, you see, I was going to go out there and push the car into the next town by myself. And I was on an incline. Both ways. So I got back there, and I put my back into it, and I started to push, and I pushed. Oh, I might add, I also, before that, I had fallen asleep. All of us were kind of bunched up in the front seat so that we'd keep each other warm. We had blankets piled on top of each other. And my head was under the steering wheel. And so my wife says, "Here comes a car." I forgot the steering wheel was there. And so I came up real fast, and I gave myself a mouse that was a mouse. I mean, I had a black eye like you couldn't believe. And I had to teach Bible class the next morning. Try to explain that. Finally, some guy stopped. He says, "Hey, do you need help?" "Yes." Of course, by then I was perspiring, 25 below weather. When we finally got to our destination, it was 50 below that night. I've never experienced cold like that, ever. Nor will I ever again. You say, was that preventive suffering? It was suffering. More than likely, punitive. I didn't even try to figure it out then. All I wanted to do was get better. See, God wants to bless us. Isn't that odd? God wants to bless us. But he can't. Why? Because we stand in the way. Remember, God cannot bless when there's no capacity for blessing. Now, if there's any of you here this morning that think that God has not set aside any blessing for you, you're wrong. Under equal privilege and equal opportunity, every believer has had set aside on their behalf blessings. Some will experience them in time. And by the way, that's the down payment of the reality of the hope that we have in eternity. Because if we know we have blessing in time, then we know we're going to have blessing in eternity. And if we don't have blessing in time, and by the way, what I call blessing is not what most of you call blessing. Your car started this morning, so that was a blessing. No, it wasn't. It was wise maintenance. I don't know what that means, bless the food. How can you bless food? You thank God for it. And I notice some here still just chow down, never even bother bowing their heads and thanking God for the food. And we're told to do that. And you don't know where that's been. And who handled that last? And where that hand was that handled it last was. Think about that one. You'll not eat again. Anybody that's ever worked in a restaurant knows what goes on in the back. I did for a short period of time in my life, and I can remember a steak coming right out of the plate and onto the ground. The waiter just picked the steak up, put it back in, and so I looked through the windows, you know, that you have on the swinging doors to see where he was going with that thing. And the next minute I saw that guy just, oh man, he was, and he looked so good. And 5 minutes before it was on the ground. Say, how often did you eat there? Never. No, I did when I fixed my own. And you know what would have happened if he hadn't had that? He'd have complained. Where's my food? And you're going to use the excuse, well, it fell on the ground, so I had to give you a new one? Oh, yeah. So say nothing. Everybody's happy. Except me. Punitive preventive suffering is an administration of punishment to the guilty. And remember, there's also cursing by association. And so if you're well aware of the, except if you're married, if you're well aware of the fact that discipline is being directed by God to a particular member of the body of Christ, stay clear of that individual. Because discipline has a way of spreading. As with blessing, stay close to believers that you're aware that are being blessed. Now, I think we've defined blessing sufficiently enough. It's not that your car started this morning. It's not that you got up on time and went to work. It's not that you even have a job. That's all logistical support. See, God provides logistically food, shelter, clothing, transportation, and at least one assembly that you can attend to learn the Word of God. That's all a part of logistical support. Now, these things can eventually be a blessing in your life, but the supply of these things are not blessings. We erroneously call them blessings, but blessings come from the justice of God and are absolutely phenomenal. They're far beyond that which we can think. Remember, eye has not seen, ear heard. Remember that? Nor hath it entered in the mind of man what God has prepared for those that love him. That includes time as well as eternity. And I think the blessings in time must be parlayed to blessings in eternity, because we cannot receive our eternal blessings here. We wouldn't be able to relate to them. Nor will our temporal blessings in time be related to eternity. One area that we know of is temporal blessing in time, is wealth. Another could be health and longevity. Some of you are saying, well, I know I'm not being blessed in that area. All right. How about wealth? Definitely not. We haven't reached maturity yet. And as soon as you do, there could be a great outpouring. And it's not that you'll win the lottery. God doesn't work through lotteries. I remember a person saying to me years ago about another person who worked in Las Vegas. And he said to me, you know, he says, I feel sorry for Las Vegas if that man ever reaches super grace. And I said, why? He says, he'll win everything he gambles at. Got a problem with that, Charlie. God is not the big dealer in the sky. Blackjack. All right, you win. See, what is gambling? Well, sometimes it's stupidity, other times it's entertainment. I love to watch people. When we were still in New York, once a month we went to the Bowery. And the reason for that was not only to minister to the needs of the derelicts in that area. And we had two particular places that we used to go. Both were rescue missions. But the experience that we would have going there and watching the people in general. See, they're not the same as Long Islanders. People who live in New York City are a breed of their own. Of course, I can understand them. I even speak their language. You sit there and watch them at stoplights. Head down, and boy, they're going. Where are they going? I don't know, but they're going. Everybody's in a hurry. And they're kind of like, maggots or roaches or whatever, just running around, and get around, and they skirt around each other. They're not even looking at each other. And occasionally you'll see somebody fall down. They don't stop and help them. No. We don't do that. We're too busy. We're like the rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. I'm late. They're always late. And I've seen many a person who was near death, and they would step right over them or skirt around them till finally somebody would take note. A good Samaritan. Now, if a guy goes like this, starts gasping and falls to the ground, you have a pretty good case of heart attack, wouldn't you think? Or gas. Or if he's turning blue, you know, there's no oxygen going where it needs to go. So how then does punitive preventive suffering work in the life of the believer? It's a warning. It's getting your attention. It's like the tap on the shoulder. Matter of fact, no parent has ever been successful in the raising of their children unless they use punitive preventive suffering. I know it's getting harder and harder to do that. Because now if you strike a child, you can go to jail. You see, everything that is being done today with regard to child rearing is based on anti-biblical principles. And then they turn around and say, why are our children the way they are in the schools? There's no discipline. That's why. You can't educate without discipline. Have you ever been in a church, by the way, where children are allowed to run through the auditorium or sanctuary and pound on the piano? I have. I've been in churches where kids actually walked on the keys because of the noise it made. And the mother would simply say, now, honey, don't do that. My kids never did that because they knew they wouldn't have feet. They go through life footless. Hey, what happened to your feet? Well, I tried to play the piano once with my feet. And the lid came down so hard, it just chopped them both off. No, I wouldn't have done that, but I used to threaten them that I would. See, they never knew when I was telling them the truth. Half of the things I said I was going to do to them, I wouldn't have done. They didn't know that, though. We had an expression at the dinner table. How would you like me to jump across the table and push your head right through that wall? Why? Because they were eating like pigs. Or fighting with their food. And they think you didn't see that. You know, the old pea on the fork, you know that kind of... And Laura would go, Dad. So I blame Pam. Because they always pointed to her. She did it. They were two conspiring children. Oh, were they conspiratorial. Everything was Pam's fault. Well, say, how did you ever find out about these things? Oh, they told me long after they were gone and married. Now, Dad, I just want you to know, we used to go to White's store and we'd punch holes in the bread. And that must have been so much fun, taking their thumbs and putting it through the wrapper into the bread. But they'd never come home after having done that and said, guess what we did at the store today? I never knew what the attraction was. Why does anybody want to go to a grocery store? Well, number one, I think it was the only store in the area. And then two, thumb in the bread stuff, see? That's fun. Yeah, these sweet things that you know now as adults. And some of you are smiling because I bet you did the same thing or close to it. Often the purpose of providential preventive suffering is to learn obedience, self-discipline. And therefore the result would be either enforced or genuine humility. You see, one thing you must know, that before you can go from the filling of the Spirit of gate one to the learning process of gate four, there are two things that you're confronted with immediately. And that is, are you genuinely, or has it to be enforced upon you to be humble? Both work. And two, are you authority-oriented? No one can learn without authority orientation. And I think that's probably one of the successes of Westside Private School. The teacher's demands on the children. I know it was that way when I was here. And it's going to be that way again if it's been lost. I don't think it has. Not from our teachers anyway. That's why the public schools can't teach. There's no authority orientation. They give you this look like, who do you think you are? I had one when I was subbing on Long Island. I had a ninth grade history class. And one of them said to me, well, who are you? I says, I'm the sub. Well, subs don't do anything. They just come in and sit and read magazines and let us do whatever we want to do. And I says, that's not the way it works in my book. I have a lesson plan here that your teacher left, and we're going to do that lesson. Whew! I have my rights, he said to me. I got your rights. And he learned his rights very quickly. He had no portfolio as far as I was concerned. And I heard one of them saying to another as they were leaving the class and the other class was coming in, hey, don't mess with this guy. So I had no problems the rest of the day. Of course, the school never asked me back. Who knows the complaints? They never called me complaining, but I'm sure there must have been complaints. Don't take nonsense. Got a job to do. And it works in every area of life. You're subject to your boss, your immediate supervisor, who's subject to his immediate supervisor, and up the chain of command. And you don't go to the top of the chain when you have maybe three people in between. That's a lack of orientation to the chain of command of authority. that way here at Westside. You don't come to me when you have a problem with bushes out front. I'm not going to do anything about it. First of all, those clippers don't even fit in my hands. I tried it. I gave that up about 20 years ago. It just doesn't work. Then I'm allergic to Bermuda, so I can't run those lawnmowers. Say, what a convenient thing. Of course it is. I learned a long time ago that mops slip right out of my hand. They're just, something's wrong there. I have a malformed hand. And yet, in the hands of my wife, she does a beautiful job. Hers fit perfectly. She does her thing. I do that, just falls right out. Sometimes vacuuming. The vacuum, for some reason, doesn't fit. Sometimes it does. See, that's when you want to do it and you don't want to do it. Exactly. Understanding men and women. A woman worries about the future until she gets a husband. A man never worries about the future until he gets a wife. There's more of these. A man will pay $2 for a $1 item he wants. A woman pays $1 for a $2 item that she doesn't need. There are two times when a man doesn't understand a woman. Before marriage and after marriage. If you don't like these, email Larry Hoffman. He sent them to me. In either event, these are generally short-term sufferings, especially in the area of punitive suffering. Its design is to get your attention to the very thing that you've turned from. Remember, when you're out of fellowship, you're acting exactly and thinking exactly the same as you did as a non-believer. That's your motivation. You have nothing else. You can't apply biblical principles when you're out of fellowship. It's impossible. The mechanics aren't there. And the main strength of the application of the principle is the Spirit of God, and He's grieved. So you could go through the motions. It may fool somebody else. But God isn't fooled. That's, I guess, what is commonly referred to as playing church. You know, they assume the look, whatever that look is, carry the Bible a certain way, speak a certain way, in that squeaky little voice. And we're talking about men. Kind of speak through their teeth. Like, you know what? You shake their hand and you almost want to apologize for hurting them. I've got better handshakes out of a piece of limp linguine than I did out of some believers. That's the way I check linguine, by the way. It's about the average believer. Handshake. Do we not need obedience to learn? Yes. Do we not need self-discipline? Of course. See, God knows He can't bless us without these things. Genuine humility, and it's not standing in the corner looking like a wallflower. Genuine humility is based on authority orientation. And you see it even in the life of Paul. He says, when I think I'm something, I realize I'm nothing. And when I'm nothing, then I realize how everything he is. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but you understand the principle. That's humility. Humility is not walking around, you know, slumped shoulders, speaking softly. No. No, you can square your shoulders and walk uprightly. Like a human being instead of an ape. Chimpanzees are very humble. No man can reach maturity without genuine humility. Impossible. What, by the way, what is it that makes a marriage work? Genuine humility.
If it's not there, they're constantly at each other's throats. God never intended, by the way, for two human beings to act like some people do in marriage. Here a while back, someone asked me, how long have you been married? And I said, over 45 years. And, wow. And to what do you attribute your success? This is not my success, it's our success. And what does it really involve? Setting your agenda aside. Now, y'all learned that when you had children. It's not quite their agenda, but it's pretty close. You have to keep reminding them, however, and do, that they're guests. And they won't be around much longer. You begin telling them that when they're four. I'll never forget the first time I heard a rather crude doctor, I guess technically speaking it's correct, was talking about an impregnation or a pregnancy, and he described the embryo as a germ, kind of like a virus, because it's living off the host, and that's the parent. And then when they're born, you say, yes, he's right. Not quite. But children are so parent dependent, and rightfully so. But a lot of parents aren't there for their children. Now, you can also become ridiculous and become so overbearing and overprotective that the child never gets any experience in life. And there are certain things they just have to do on their own. And learn on their own. Is there anyone here that never went against their parents and played with matches? And when you burned yourself, you knew what they were talking about. We've all gone through that. Most of the men here, especially those that are mechanical, had to put that temperature gauge, that thermometer, either under hot water, or, like we had back east, a radiator. And watch the red go to the surface and blow the top. Say, well, I never did that. I said, those that are mechanical. You want to see that. I've done some very crazy things in my life. I almost killed myself one time. Well, more than one time. And I can't say but by the grace of God, because I wasn't a believer. That we might call that providential stupidity. And look what kids do today that they suffer for the rest of their lives, especially in the area of drugs. I had a personal friend who was involved in drugs as a young man. He then became a believer. He then went through Bible school and college and graduated. He then became a pastor of a church. Couldn't last. He'd actually have LSD flashbacks in the pulpit. Great minister of the word. Terrific scholar. Phenomenal student of the word. Begin to teach, and all of a sudden, he'd go off somewhere. He went to bye-bye land. He finally had to end up out. Couldn't take it. Now, if you put him in that same circumstance and say, now, let's go back to your youth, would you do that now? No. Certainly not. I remember when I was growing up, only lowlife did that. You know, the dirge of the earth. Now it's popular in higher circles. Orientation to life is orientation to the laws of establishment. And once you begin to understand the concepts of authority orientation, if nothing else, you see, that's why people are in prison. That's why people go to jail. That's why people are fined. That's why we have law enforcement. And I suppose, in a strict sense, the medical profession many times is directed as the police officer because someone has not followed the laws of good health. We abuse our bodies, quite frankly. And I'm certainly not going to stand up here and give you a list, because I have to be very selective not to include me in that list, because I certainly don't want to address my problems. We have to go through suffering. It's the way we learn. And the things we learn the fastest is based on the degree to which we've suffered. Let's go back to the match. Or even worse yet, the hot stove. I'm talking about the old pot bellies. A child learns very, very quickly to stay away from that. Even though they can feel the radiance of the heat, it isn't until they do exactly what they were told not to do. Now all of a sudden they pull back a finger that has its skin removed. And they cry. I'm a quick learner when it comes to pain. I don't like pain. And I have a low toleration for it. I'm one of those, give me too much pain, I'm gone. Now, I can see you walking around with an eye missing and it's not going to bother me. But if it happens to my family, next time you're talking to Robin, right on the side of her face you'll see a little scar. I passed out when she did that. She didn't, I did. She cried and I passed out. I'll see your blood, but not mine. I don't want to see my blood or the blood of my children. I had a man who was one of our deacons in our last church. He had a boat. Some of you know this. You're going to hear it again. Why? Because it involves pain. And he had it dry docked. And he had this big boom that he used to use to swing it out into the channel and then to lower the boat to the dock. And he says, John, I want to show you something. I said, what? He said, hop in. He was already in the boat. I hopped in and I had my head turned. And as I turned to look what he was doing, I walked right into that beam. Every time I got in his boat, I looked for that beam. That was still on shore. Let's go fishing. And every time I came to that spot, I would duck. Where's the beam? Back on the dock. You understand what it is? It's not a beam. It's a thing that comes out, a boom. There you go. And it went boom, right across here. We learn from our suffering. That's why you can't be too overly protective with children. They have to learn somehow. Oh, you don't want them a bloody mess. I'm not talking about that. Or you don't let them play with razor blades so they know what it feels like to get cut. Some of you are extremists. I know you are. Because you're either on this side or you turn right around and you jump clear across the other side. Now, there is a happy medium. There's a balance there. You let them play with dull razor blades. No. You notice, by the way, how technical children are today? 4 and 5 years old? I mean, Krisha comes in the house. We've got three different... They're not clickers. remotes. They used to be clickers. Because they made a clicking sound, and they actually sent a signal, a mechanical signal. But now it's electronic. So anyway, she sits in my chair, which is all right, and she's got all three of them going. And she knows what she's doing. Some of your VCRs are still flashing on 12. Let's take up first punitive preventive suffering. This was all intro. One, punitive preventive suffering is related to the believer in spiritual childhood. While providential preventive suffering is related to the believer in spiritual adulthood. And the way I usually like to outline this to make it easy for you to see is that in spiritual childhood, here's the love sphere, here's gate one, and or the filling of the Spirit. Here's gate eight, which is maturity. From there you have two, three, four. These two combine to set up four. Four is the learning gate. That's where you are right now. If you are absent of any one of the first three, you can't learn. And the easiest way to learn is to be taught categorically. Now, from here to here is childhood stage, spiritual childhood. As you begin to advance, you move into gates 5 and 6. Now your momentum begins to build, and you're going into spiritual adolescence. And then finally, gates 7 and 8, you're moving into spiritual adulthood. And by the time you reach gate 8, that's the penthouse. That's the mature gate. That's where blessing comes in your life. Now you see, if you're not even overcoming in gate 2 with authority orientation, you don't like anybody telling you what to do, you'll never get to gate 8. Because somebody has to tell you what to do in gate 4. And these same type of people, by the way, have no humility, have no authority orientation, and they wonder why they can't keep a job. Who wants that? No boss wants your ideas, unless they ask for it. But boy, are we quick to give them or criticize. There's an old adage, it's an old Chinese proverb. He who signs the checky has the right to do the speaky. Whose name is on your check? You say, mine. Who else? My boss. Good for you. Who has the right then to tell you what to do, what not to do while you're on the job? Some of you haven't learned that. I know you haven't. Because you have your own agenda. And I don't care what job it is, you'll never last or be successful in it. And then I hear people say, well, I think I'll be self-employed. I'll be my own boss. No, you're not. When you're self-employed, who are your bosses? Everyone you work with or for. A gardener says, I'm self-employed. And every garden you get involved in, the owner of that house owes you, or rather owns you. You owe them. They sign the check. Remember the old Chinese proverb? Say, where'd that proverb come from? I made it up.